You are listening to the strongest podcast in CrossFit. This is the Type 1 Lifting Podcast. Before we start the show, I would like to thank the sponsors that are helping this podcast grow. The first one is Liberté Lifestyle. They have the best knee sleeves in the game. These knee sleeves are absolutely no joke. They gave me a promo code too as well, Type 1, to get 10% off each item you buy. They also have women's clothes, men's clothes, wrist wraps, pretty much you name it, they have it. And the second one is Hero Barbell. This barbell is by far the best barbell that I've ever used in the game. It is also one of the fastest growing barbell companies in the functional fitness community, as well as other branches in the fitness space. So they also gave me a promo code too as well, and which is Type 1, which gives you 10% off of their barbells. I'm telling you, the spin on these barbells are insane. But these are the two sponsors I have, and I want to thank them so much for being a part of the show. And now, here we go. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the Type 1 Lifting Podcast. I have the creator and owner of Spider Chalk, James Hobson. How you doing?
Great.
Hey, thank you for coming on. And it's funny because one of the guys at the gym that I train at told me about Spider Chalk. And I was like, oh, what is this? And he's like, oh, he's a local guy. He does like chalk for the powerlifters, CrossFitters, you name it. And so I was doing some research and I was like, oh, you're like really close to me. You're in the town next over now, but you're originally from Gainesville.
Yeah. So we're only about 30 minutes away.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. And then, we started talking before the podcast, a couple of weeks ago, and I felt like we hit it off easily.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if we lived in the same town, we'd probably be hanging out, working out together.
True. Facts. But you've been in the CrossFit game for a long time. So you're I think your first affiliate was one of the top, the first 125 affiliates. Yeah. in the country, in the world for CrossFit.
Yeah. So I started doing CrossFit in 2007, but my affiliate opened in 2008 and we were definitely in the top 120. I mean, I think if I remember correctly, we were about 113 or mm-hmm. so about the 113th. And that was back when there was one CrossFit in every major city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And what made you steer towards, doing CrossFit compared to regular bro splits or anything like that?
So I was a personal trainer. I went and backpacked through South America twice. And after I got done backpacking through South America for a little under a year, I went to New Zealand, did some backpacking there.
Oh, that's sick.
Came back. Yeah. I didn't have a job after being gone for almost a year. So I decided that I wanted to be a personal trainer, and I worked at LA Fitness for a long time. And a buddy turned me on to CrossFit. I watched the Nasty Girls video. Have you ever seen the Nasty Girls video?
I think if you're an OG, if you haven't seen the Nasty Vert Girls video, then there's something wrong with you.
So I watched the Nasty Girls video, and that day I told my buddy, I said, I'm doing this. So I called up CrossFit Atlanta, which was the only CrossFit in all of North Georgia. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the original 10 or 15 CrossFit gyms. I called them up and I said, I want to start. So I went down there the next morning and I did a workout with them and ended up joining CrossFit. And that's how I got started in 2007.
Nice. And do you remember your first workout at all? Or it's some people do, but but it's been a long time.
Yeah. I actually do, because I don't remember the exact workout, but I do. They got a picture of it my first day.
Okay.
And they got a picture of me running down the sidewalk, which is funny because I didn't run at all. So I went into CrossFit and I said this can't be too hard. I mean, I'm a personal trainer. Mm-hmm. And they made me do push-ups and pull-ups and some thrusters and some different stuff, but which was all fine. And then they said, you got to run a 400 meter after every round. And I thought, 400 meters, what is that? And they go, that's a quarter mile. So I take off running and I turn around at the turnaround point. And I'm coming back and you can see my face. I have the original picture of my first workout and the face says it all. It looks like I'm dying. And my first workout was really tough. It wasn't anything memorable as far as programming. It was just, it had a run in it. And that was the end for me. As soon as I got to that run, I was wiped.
Yeah. 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 You probably were wiped throughout the rest of the day. You're just taking a nap and doing absolutely nothing. So
I remember I got home and I told my wife, I said, Babe, it was the easiest workout in the world until I got to the run. And then as soon as I got to the run, it was over. It went from the easiest workout in the world to the hardest workout in the world in 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So when did you think the clock still, like, you know, when did the mind start churning a little bit before you wanted to even open your own affiliate?
The gym that I went to, I talked to the owner there and I said, I'd like to become a coach. And he said, well, if you want to become a coach, you have to go get certified. And this was back when certifications only came through your area like once a year.
Yep.
So there was one in Florida. And I said, well, man, if I'm going to go get this certification to be a CrossFit coach and spend all this money, because it's expensive. I said, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to start my own gym. I'm not going to go work for somebody else and, you know, have someone telling me what to do. So I immediately got my certification, whatever weekend it came up. And then I started my CrossFit gym like 4 or 5 months later. So it was pretty immediate that as soon as I decided I wanted to get my certification, I immediately pivoted to like, well, I'm just going to open my own gym.
So did you find a place pretty quickly? And like, was the landlord being like, wait, so what are you building in here?
Yeah. So back in the day, so the original CrossFit gyms were always in old condemned warehouses and industrial zones. And the theory that Greg Glassman had was go to the cheapest part of town and get the biggest warehouse you can for a couple dollars a square foot. It doesn't need to be nice. As long as it's got high ceilings, one toilet and one sink and a concrete floor, you're good. And so I looked around and there wasn't any industrial stuff where I was at, but I did find this little retail shopping center. It used to be an AT&T store. It was 1,000 square feet, retail, glass front, but on the back of it, it had a roll-up door.
Oh, and cool.
So I signed a lease there. It had a bathroom in it, and it actually had a shower, which no one ever used, but it had the roll-up door and 1,000 square feet. And let me tell you, 1,000 square feet sounds pretty big until you get about 10 people in there slinging barbells around, and there were holes in the wall like every 3 feet from where we dropped the barbell from overhead, and it would go sideways and punch a hole in the wall. When we moved out of that space, we ended up having to redo the entire wall, all 1,000 square feet. We had to demo it and redo the drywall, and I did it with my landlord when I moved out. I actually went in there and did the drywall with him because we had to replace everything. The whole place was completely destroyed. It was like Swiss cheese.
Yeah. So did you move to another place after that, correct?
Yeah. So our first place was 1,000 square feet. It was retail. Then we moved to 4,000 square feet. We found a big, I think the ceilings were 24 feet. Dang. It was 4,000 square feet. It had two big roll-up doors. It was the whole building. We had the whole parking lot in front. We actually had the whole street. So we just moved up to a much bigger location after year number three.
Very cool. Very cool. So obviously being like in the cut, can you consider like you, when you started kind of like the infancy of CrossFit?
So in 2007, CrossFit was drastically different than it is now.
Yeah.
The vibe, the community, the culture, HQ. Look at all the guys that you know from like 5 years ago in CrossFit that are kind of getting out of it. They were just starting in 2007. And I mean, all the guys that run the games, all the big games athletes that have won it, you know, 3, 4, 5 times or place 3, 4, 5 times. They were all just getting started in 2008. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was no games in 2007, 2008, because they did it at the ranch. So the vibe was completely different. And honestly, that's what attracted me the most was the fact that it was very libertarian based. It was very free. It was open source. Nobody told you what you could do or couldn't do. You were free to run everything the way you wanted. What you were paying for was just using the name CrossFit. That was it. And they gave you total autonomy. And that's changed pretty drastically over the last 20 years, 15 years.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously being in the beginning of the CrossFit space, did you get like, you know, regular and not regular access, but did you get some access to like Greg Glassman and like the everyone else in HQ? It was probably like a little bit easier than it is now just to get just to reach that.
Absolutely, much easier. I never spoke to Greg personally over the phone, but he did come to Atlanta and we got to hang out for a weekend. He invited all the owners of all the CrossFit gyms to come. There weren't that many. So he came and we spent a few days together. So that was really cool. But yeah, HQ was just a phone call away. I mean, at that time you would email HQ and one of the like three people that worked there would email you back like an hour later.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, I think even at the time you could call them and they would answer the phone. I mean, it was very small. And I think, you know, even in year number three, we were up to like 300 or 500 affiliates. It was still very tiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you ever think about going another path, doing like another type of gym space compared to doing CrossFit before, you know, even opened up that first gym?
No, but while I owned that CrossFit gym, I got to know lots of other owners. And every time a new gym would open up, I'd go to their grand opening and we'd just chit chat and work out together. And then I would email them and call them like once a week and just chat it up, see how they're doing. And over the course of a few years, I had this idea that we should merge gyms. We should get three or four of us and we should merge gyms by like 25,000 square feet, an old Gold's Gym or something, mm-hmm. with the locker rooms and the sauna and the whole thing. This was my idea. This was like 2010, 2011. Get four or five gyms, merge them together, have one guy running the boot camp, one guy running the games training, one guy running the kids program, one guy running the sports performance program. So when you walk in as a family, husband, wife, three kids, you've got a teenager, a middle schooler, and an elementary school. You go, we've got a boot camp for the mom. We've got a powerlifting strength, you know, for the dad. Mm-hmm. High school kids, we've got a sports performance program. Middle school kid, we've got a high intensity CrossFit GPP program. And then for the elementary school kids, we've got CrossFit kids. The nice thing about that idea is if you get four owners together, now you've got four people who can work there. Mm-hmm. So if you get sick or you go on vacation, you still got three guys. Versus if you own your own CrossFit gym, the problem is you have to be there. You're there at 4:35 in the morning. You're there at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. You're there on Saturdays. Anytime you're open on a Sunday afternoon or something, you got to be there. So, I mean, it's a 7-day a week job and there's no break. If you get sick or break a leg or something, you still got to go. So yep. That was my idea back then. And the problem was I couldn't get anybody else to bite on it. People in CrossFit are so independent.
Yeah.
That was the reason why they didn't want to give up their vision of what their gym should look like. And you go, mm-hmm. but don't you see how it would be easier if we just did it together? And they go, no, I'd rather just do it myself and work 80 hours a week. I said, okay. Well,
yeah. That's why you see their kids there and they just like literally swing on the, you know, the Olympic rings or just like climb the rope easily. And they're just like, not little savages, but they're like, they're like strong, strong kids. Cause they're like living there all the time. Cause that's, they don't have like the parents don't have a life because they're too busy coaching.
Yeah.
It's all for the love.
Yeah. At the same time though, it's a young man's game. Mm-hmm. I did it for almost 7 years. 2008, so eight years. And after 8 years, I was exhausted. I was drained, you know, and you don't get to see your kids grow up and you really get to see your wife unless she comes to the gym all the time. You actually spend more time with your members than you do with your family.
Yep.
And so that was the deal breaker for me. After 8 years, I said, you know what? I'm going to prioritize my family and the rest of these people can just go get in shape somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So did you sell it to somebody else or did you just like close the shop altogether?
So I own the Atlanta Affiliate League, which was our competition series that I started in Atlanta. And a gentleman approached me at one of my events and said, would you be interested in bringing on a partner? And I said, no, but I'd be interested in selling. And he was an older guy, very established, extremely wealthy. And he said, I'd love to buy your gym. So we met for coffee. I brought him the books and showed him the numbers. And he made me an offer while we were drinking coffee. So it was all done in 24 hours.
That's awesome.
We had the contract signed the next day. It was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I heard in a podcast, this was like a while ago, that like Atlanta was one of like the hotbeds to like own a CrossFit gym down here. Cause like it was, they were like, all of a sudden, like they were just popping off all over the place. Was that true?
Yeah. There were 238. When I sold my gym, I still did the Atlanta Affiliate League. So I reached out to all 238 CrossFit owners. I had an email list with 238 affiliates on it. And that was within like 30 minutes. When you get 45 minutes or an hour away, which is still technically the mm-hmm. metro, you start to get over 300. So there was 238 active affiliates that in the Atlanta area. I mean, and here's the other thing. It was crazy because if you drive to a CrossFit, you'd cross three CrossFits to get to the one that you would put in GPS. And I remember going to some of my buddies' gyms and I'm driving down the street and it's like a CrossFit on the left. And then at the next stoplight, a CrossFit on the right. and then another one next door to his across the street. They were across the street from each other in Atlanta.
That's crazy. Yep. That's crazy. Yeah. But you were talking earlier about the Atlanta Affiliate League. So can you kind of delve into like a little bit more of that? Because you told me on the phone before, but for the people, the audience that don't know what that is, you know, can you let them know?
So the Atlanta Affiliate League was the very first multi-week sports league for CrossFit. And if you've ever played baseball or tennis, there's a tournament, right? And, you know, round robin tournament, or you do a bracket tournament. Well, it's fun because you have a team and you're going to play the regular season where you play every team once. And then that puts you into a bracket, seeds you into a bracket, and then it's single elimination down to the final. That's how every sports works. If you go intramurals at college, that's how sports work, right? But CrossFit wasn't like that. CrossFit, up until that point, all the competitions were individual. So you'd show up and you'd be in the open division, which is scaled, or you'd be in RX division, and scaled and RX individual. That was it. There were no team workouts. So I came up with the idea that said, let's do team workouts, but instead of you getting a team and showing up one day, it's your team versus all the other teams in Atlanta. So you have a home game 1 week, and then you have an away game 1 week. And all the teams would go to the different CrossFits. One time would be away. They'd come to you the next week and be your home game. And after you played every team, you know, home and away, then that got seeded for the bracket. And the bracket was on a Saturday. It was on a single day. And we would, all the teams would compete in the bracket until we got down to the final two teams, and that was the championship team. So it was anywhere between a 6 week and an 8 week season. At the end of the 8 week season, you had a single Saturday where the teams went and competed in a bracket. So it was just like playing real sports.
That's awesome.
Super fun because everyone made uniforms. You came up with a name, you had your full uniform on, and you went to the other team's gym to compete. And then the next week they would come to your gym to compete. That was the Atlanta Affiliate League.
Yeah. So it's almost like an early stage of like kind of like the grid league.
Yeah. So that's, we were actually the first people to do the league. And then we got calls from the grid league and the Florida. There was one called the Florida Affiliate League or something. There was all these other leagues that popped up, but they all contacted us at the time, contacted me at the time and said, hey man, can you tell me how you do it and why you do it this way and the whole thing. So I got to know all those guys when they were just getting started.
Mm-hmm. So how much of a pain in the butt was it just to get that thing started and get everybody like, you know, involved and say, hey, you know, we should definitely do this. Just try it out and just, you know, go for it.
So the first time we did, it was probably 2010. And I had a certain amount of space because I'd already done the chart, the home and the way, you know, I did the Excel spreadsheet, and I think we had room for 10 teams. We sold that out in one day. And then the second time we did it, which was like 3 months later, I expanded it to 20 teams and that sold out within like 48 hours. And then the third time we did it, I did East and West. So I had to split the state of Atlanta because you can't be on the west side of Atlanta and drive to the east side of Atlanta. It's like over an hour with traffic.
Nightmare.
So people were balking at that, saying like, well, they came to me, but they don't, you know, they don't want to come. You know what I'm saying? Like people came to that gym, but then that gym didn't want to go to their gym the week following. So I said, well, we'll just split it down the middle. We've got East and West. And then we eventually split it East, West, North, and South. So you only played the people in your region. And then you have your bracket. And then those brackets came together for the final four on a Saturday. So that's how we did it. Eventually, the Atlanta League had to change our format because the logistics just got overwhelming. I mean, when you start getting to like 30 teams, it just gets overwhelming and it's hard to plan it. And the gyms start getting upset about, you know, the driving distance and everything. Even though we split it into regions, there was always something that came up and two teams couldn't line up. You know, somebody wants to do 10 a.m. on Saturday and the only team, the other team can only do after 1 p.m. on Saturday. And so they both get a draw or a loss or whatever. And then we couldn't figure out how to make it work. So then we switched over our format to large team format called Super Team.
Okay. Okay. Very cool. That's awesome. That must have been just a headache with all like people just bitching and moaning and being like, oh, like I can't do this, can't do that. And you're just like, just deal with it. Just go. Who cares?
Yeah. And I'll tell you, man, after owning two CrossFit gyms and the Atlanta League, the part that sticks with you long term is the fact that people will find a reason to complain about everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's something innate in human beings. you could have the best programming, the best competition, everything, and still you'll get bombarded with people. They just can't help it. Mm-hmm. People love to complain.
Yeah, definitely. So how did you get the people? How did you get people to come and judge the competitions that you had?
So in the beginning, the way we did it was we said that if you have a host, so if you're a home game, you have to supply the judges for the event. That's part of being the host gym. And again, when we were doing the league, that worked out really well. But mm-hmm. then all of a sudden, towards the end, the last cycle or two, the last season, we called them seasons, the last couple seasons, you had people say, "Hey, man, we would have won, but their judge." And I'm going, "Oh, come on.
Come on, guys. Come on. Come on."
You know, and like, if you don't respond, anything you respond to that, they screenshot it and they put it up on Facebook and say, "Look at what this jerk said." You know what I mean? So if you say, "Hey, you know, I know that guy, he's a really good guy, there's no way he would do something like that," they go, "Oh, how dare you call me a liar." Mm-hmm. And if you say, "Hey, if something happened, no big deal, we'll fix it," and they'll say, "He admitted that something went wrong and that we should have won." I'm telling you, man, like it's crazy. Like when you get into dealing with massive amounts of people, it's extremely difficult. And these are people that I saw on a regular basis. They'll email you and they'll rip you a new one. And then 2 days later, you'll see them and they'll come up to you and they'll go, "Bro," and they'll hug you and like, "Man, how's the family?" And you're going, "Oh, he's not so tough now."
Yes.
Everyone's tough over email, but when you get face to face, things change real quick.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Keyboard warriors. That's all they are. So, and it's like that's in some people I've actually seen it when I was playing lacrosse too. Like, and I played in the old man lacrosse league in Georgia. So it was like 35 and over. And so you would see even like people that were like high level CrossFit athletes, like they still want to play like the way they did in college or whatever. And it's just like, guys, like I got to go to work tomorrow. Like, you know, I want to have fun, but like you were just making this like 10 times worse.
Yeah. And some guys, CrossFit athletes, I'll say this, the majority of the guys that are really good, that are very competitive, and this is going back to 2010. It wasn't any different in 2010 than it was 5 years ago or three years ago, because I closed it down during COVID. The Atlanta League ran from 2010 all the way to 2021. So it was 11 years I ran the Atlanta Affiliate League. And we did multiple events a year. And this is what I noticed about the guys who compete and the girls. I'm just saying the competitive athletes is that they're jerks. They're egotistical. They're extremely self-absorbed. Every once in a while, you'll meet one of them that's like a decent human being, but the majority of them are schmucks. And I'll be honest, man, like you have to almost be that way in order to be that level. My college roommate was like a three-sport athlete. He was an absolute stud. And he's just a terrible human being. I mean, he just was. But he had the confidence to walk in there. And as soon as he walked into any room, he thought, "I'll whoop these people. Like, they're nothing compared to me." And that mindset is something that like gets you really far in sports, but it also makes you a very tough person to be around in real life. Horrible person to be married to.
Yeah. And it's like, and it's almost really hard to get rid of that as well. Like after you leave this, like the sports world, like a lot of guys that I know went to college, like D1 colleges and just don't play sports anymore. And so, and like, I can't imagine like how they can switch their attitude from where they were for the first like 21 years, not like, you know, roughly like 18 years of their life or whatever, to, you know, after college. And it's definitely still coming around, but I don't even know how people can change since you've been doing that kind of stuff for so long.
Well, it is weird because when you meet older guys who used to be really good athletes, in their mind, they're still 22. And it's guilty. Very difficult for them to move past it.
Yeah.
It's all they've got. You know what I mean? And if you were a guy with a 350-pound clean and jerk and a 7-minute mile 10 years ago, you're still that guy in your head. You haven't evolved. You look in the mirror and you look older, but you feel the same that you did 10 years ago. And one thing I'll say about like the elite athlete community, which isn't just CrossFit. This is every sport. I mean, mm-hmm. I've played every sport there is, and I coach college volleyball. There's a difference between online and in real life. Online, you have 200,000 followers and you get lots of comments. And you are legitimately an influencer. Mm-hmm. You're a person that is semi-famous, legitimately. But as soon as you turn that computer off or put that cell phone down, you're just another guy. You walk into Walmart, nobody cares. You go to your kid's school, nobody knows that you have 200,000 followers. Nobody knows that you can clean and jerk 350 or can run a 7-minute mile. Nobody knows you were at semifinals. Nobody knows you were the stud on the basketball team at Georgia 10 years ago. Nobody remembers and nobody cares. But in your mind, you're still that person. And as long as you're on the internet and you have your phone on or your laptop on, you're still that guy. You still have 200,000 followers. But that's why so many athletes are addicted to their phones. Once they put that phone down, they're a normal human being again. And that's not the life they want. They want to hang on to that cell phone, that D1 athlete, that CrossFit athlete lifestyle as long as possible. They're 60 years old. They're still going to be on their phones getting that validation that they've gotten for the last 40 years.
Yeah, they're going to get that
dopamine
hit. That's
the real addiction.
Yeah, yeah,
get that dopamine hit. The real addiction is letting go of that image that you have of yourself and saying, it's okay to be a normal person. So what if nobody knows me? It's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. Cause like even like a lot of people don't even know who was second place in the CrossFit games like 2 years ago, let alone like, okay, who was in the wild card, you know, like who was in the wild card in the NFL, like on the, you know, AFC, you know, in the AFC, like they don't remember. Unless you're a fan of the team, but like no one cares.
No. And at CrossFit competitions, there is a little bit of hero worship. We had some guys in Atlanta that made it to the games, 3 or 4 athletes, some guys that made it to regionals. And when they came in with a posse. Like they'd come in with 3 or 4 entourage, you know, the little guys that grab onto the star athletes just so they can, you know, be in their aura. And those guys would come in and they'd sling their bag over in the middle of everybody's stuff and they'd start warming up and it was like they just had to put on the show. Very rarely do you meet someone who's a good athlete with a big following that's humble. Mm-hmm. They might put the face on and they might act like they're humble because that's part of the shtick, you know what I mean? It's part of the persona. They're very humble, but then they'll brag a lot about how humble they are, and that's where it really comes out. Yeah. So, you know, and that's something that like, this is just a part of being around athletes, whether you're college or whether you're CrossFit or whatever. It's just, you're going to be around really good athletes. You're just going to have to like roll your eyes and just keep going. You know?
Yeah.
That's never going to end. I mean, 100 years from now, people are still going to be getting off on the fact that like they have 4 people in the room that know who they are, you know, even though no one else in the room really cares.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you are the owner of Spider Chalk. So how did you even think about getting in the chalk space? Like when did that come about?
So in 2015, I made an order for liquid chalk for my gym, a pretty big order. It was like $300. And after I paid for it, I got an email saying your chalk arrives in 4 to 6 weeks. So I canceled, went to another website, ordered, got the same email 4 to 6 weeks. So I called the third website and said, hey, I'm looking for some liquid chalk. Do you have any in stock? They said, no, it's all sitting on the same boat in the middle of the ocean on the way from China. They said, there's literally no liquid chalk in the entire United States right now. And there's no block chalk either because at the time there was a shortage. So I said, well, why is that? They said, well, all the chalk in the world is made in China. So you're going to have to wait 4 weeks till that port, that ship hits. And then once it hits, we'll all have chalk. You can order from anybody. And I said, well, that's crazy. I'll start my own chalk company.
Oh, geez. And so like how much of like a learning curve did it take you to understand like how to make it, like what you need to put into it, like all like even the logistics stuff, like how did that like come about? Like how long did that take you?
It took me a while. Every product's a little bit different. We had to sew our own pouches. We have a seamstress that does some stuff for us. And we had a sock company in North Carolina that made the pouches for us. And so that took 6 months or so for them to come up with the right pouch. Then we had to have a seamstress figure out how to get the string and the clip through. So that took a couple more months. When it came to liquid chalk was a little bit easier for us. In the beginning, we called some chemistry companies, the people that do hand sanitizer and beauty products and stuff. And we said, we want to make liquid chalk. And they said, we'll put you in touch with some of our on-staff chemists. And they actually have formulation experts. So you tell them what you want to make, and then they have some people that have like PhDs in formulation, And they'll tell you, well, this is exactly what you should put in it. And they name out all the ingredients because they happen to sell all those ingredients. Mm-hmm. And so you just order all those ingredients that they tell you to, and then you mix them up in the order in which they tell you to order them. And that's how you make liquid chalk. And then Blocks was the hardest. Blocks was 18 months, an obsession. I went literally traveling across the country, having conversations with anybody and everybody that could shed some light on it. And then we went through multiple prototypes and tons of engineering and several CNC and fabrication shops until we finally figured out how to make a machine that could make blocks. That's the hard one. No one will ever figure it out. We'll literally be the only person making blocks from now until the sun burns up the earth. No one's going to do it.
I can imagine how much that machine costs.
It's wild. And not only does the machine cost a lot, but then it's very difficult to change. It's very difficult to adapt. There's a reason why no one in the world makes chalk blocks outside of China, because it's a giant pain in the rear end and it's brutally hard. And in fact, this year we decided we wanted to automate. And so we approached several automation companies and they took a look at what we wanted to do. And every single one of them said, no, they said, look, we can't invest, you know, all of our resources for 12 straight months. Like, it's just good luck, man. And so that was the end of that.
Yeah. So how many samples did it take you to actually, you know, figure out the right block that you want to sell?
Well, the machine that we made, we actually had several machines made. And the problem with all of them is none of them really worked. And so you have these machines that kind of work a little bit, but not all the way. And then you go, well, what do I do with this? I just spent $5,000 on this machine. What do I do with it now? It doesn't really make anything. And they say, well, just put it on a shelf and then we'll start over from scratch. And after the third or fourth prototype, we finally got something that worked. And the problem with that is now you have a machine that can do one block. Well, one block isn't enough to start a company. So over the next 2 to 3 years, we had to figure out ways to be able to scale so that we could start making blocks really fast. And the first big order we got was Sorinex. We private label for Sorinex. And they called us, the two owners, Bert and Richard Sorinex, called us and said, can you give us 1,500 pounds of blocks? That's 4,500 individual chalk blocks.
Dang.
So that's a big order. And I'll tell you, at the time, it was a big order, but now it's not. Now we can get orders for 20,000 pounds. An average gymnastics distributor orders 40,000 pounds. So if you can't make it really, really fast, there's no point in even doing it. Mm-hmm. And so we're at the point now where we're getting to that point where we can make it faster than we can sell it. But up until this point, we've always been able to sell it faster than we've been able to make it.
Wow, that's impressive. And you actually had a warehouse in Gainesville for a while, and you told me some stories on the phone. Can you kind of talk about those stories that you told me about?
Yeah, so in Gainesville we had a fairly large warehouse and we had a lot of workers, and we hire predominantly female workers because they're the ones that are willing to do the job that we want, which is making blocks. And at the time we had 3 or 4 girls working. And they'd show up at night, anywhere between 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock at night. And they'd work after they went to school or their other job. And we had some people get shot on our street and down the street. And it scared them a little bit. And then the other thing that scared them was we had a homeless shelter across the street from our warehouse. And the guys would be out in the parking lot when they left to walk to their cars. And so they really got scared at 10 o'clock at night in a dark parking lot when there's a bunch of strange men waiting there for them to get out. So they just spoke to me and said, hey, this doesn't feel like a really safe environment. And I said, okay. So I called my landlord and we canceled the lease and we moved up and now we work on our own property.
Yeah. And so after you canceled the lease, did you immediately think like, okay, I could do all this stuff in my house or like where I live now? Or were you still like looking around and you said, you know what, it's probably cheaper for me just to do it at my property?
So what we did was we actually found a place specifically for the business. So it had to have enough warehouses and space that we could operate, you know, a legitimate business, a manufacturing business. I mean, the state of Georgia, we're a manufacturing business. So were considered industrial for zoning. And so moving an industrial business into a, you know, residential neighborhood is, it's questionable. So you had to get the right space with the right. So we actually bought the house based on the business.
Nice, nice. and you told me it's a big property too as well.
It is. Yeah, it's anywhere between 3.5 to 5 acres, depending on like where you draw the lines. But 5 acres, let's say, we've got 2 buildings right now. We just built a third building. And then we've got a warehouse offsite that we share with a buddy of mine. It's a with a dock and everything. And that's just for storage. We don't operate out of there. We just store everything over there. And it's a buddy's warehouse. And he's nice enough to let me store all my stuff over there because we do not have enough space to store everything here and produce everything.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to keep all that stuff in your living room?
Well, it's funny. One of the reasons we never take pictures, people always say, you should take pictures of how you make the chalk or where you make the chalk. And I go, oh, we don't want to do that. Here's why. I've got the machine, my liquid, automatic liquid machine that fills all of our bottles for us. Right behind that are my kids' bikes, my hunting gear, my kids' fishing gear, and my tools. So yep. All of that sits in the same section. So, you know, it's just, and you do what you got to do. I mean, I got to fill bottles. And while I'm filling bottles, I'm moving my fishing gear and my tools around, you know, so it works for us.
Yeah. So if they have like a blind test with the blocks, like a block you can get at Academy or your block, what's the difference between yours compared to like, you know, the generic brand?
Well, the difference between our block and everyone else's, because everyone else's is made in the same factory in China, is that ours is 3 times as dense.
Yep.
So that it doesn't break or crumble apart like all the normal 2 ounce blocks do. The second thing is our block is made out of lab grade magnesium carbonate. So the stuff coming from China is a mix of powders, also very low grade mag carb. We ran some tests in the beginning. It came back a mishmash of just cheap generic powders. There's calcium carbonate in there. There's magnesium sulfate in there. There's silica in there. They're putting whatever's cheapest in that block. We're putting 100% lab grade magnesium carbonate. We compress our block. They extrude theirs. So theirs comes out in a long, like a Play-Doh, and then they cut it into blocks. And the reason they do that is because it's faster, but it makes for a very brittle block.
Yeah.
Ours, on the other hand, higher quality and doesn't break apart. That's the main difference.
Very cool. Very cool. So you've actually like, so when did your company start like blowing up? Like, do you just reach out to, once you made the company, did you just email all your friends from the CrossFit gyms that you had, you know, a relationship and say, hey, you know, I got this company, you want to try my stuff? You know, how did that work?
So no man is a prophet in his own land. Have you ever heard that?
Yes.
So when you approach all the guys that you've had relationships with for the last 5 to 10 years, you say, hey, I've got this chalk company. They all email you back and go, cool, man, good luck. And you go, well, if you need chalk, let me know. And they inevitably email you back and go, well, we just get ours from Dick's. Okay, man. You know, well, I see how great this relationship is.
Yeah.
So the answer to that is, in the beginning, the way that we grew really fast was approaching retailers. Within 2 years, I was in something like 40 or 50 retailers.
Wow.
Online websites and brick and mortar. Now we're in well over 100 and distributed in 21 countries. But at the time, it was just direct sales, emails, phone calls. Everything was word of mouth. We've never advertised until this year.
Yeah.
First year. So up until this year, it's all been word of mouth. And when we really blew up was during COVID, when Donald Trump, President Trump, blocked the borders and didn't allow anything from outside the U.S. in. All the stuff from China got stopped at the border.
Ah,
we started getting calls from everybody that said, we need chalk, and you're the only one in the country who has it. And that's when we got big.
Gosh, that you must be thanking him. Well, you must be thanking for COVID. That was huge for you.
It was huge. And he also has the right mindset. Part of the reason he did it was because of COVID, but part of it was because America doesn't manufacture anything. We're a slave to Asia. If China decides they want to take over our country, all they have to do is just stop shipping us stuff. We'd be paralyzed within a week or two.
Yep.
You get on Amazon, if you go to Walmart, everything in Amazon, everything from Walmart, everything from eBay it all comes from China. And I'm not exaggerating. Rarely can you find something not made in China. And the problem with that is, again, we're a slave to them. And people don't realize it, but Donald Trump did. And one of the things he said was, if we stop bringing in stuff from China, people in America will be forced to manufacture here. And for a very short amount of time, that was true. But then as soon as the border opened back up and the stuff started coming in back to the United States, anybody who had invested money in manufacturing went out of business because they could do it for half the price or a quarter of the price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you got your own brand, so you can just do whatever you want with it.
Yeah. And in 2022, what changed after COVID was we used our popularity to start private labeling for other companies. And that this year took off. There's a massive group of people out there that want their own branding on everything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what it is. Their socks, their hats, the cup they drink out of, they want their brand on it.
Yep.
And that's where we came in on the chalk. And over the last year, we've probably done 50% spider chalk, 50% private label.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. That's unreal.
Yeah.
And it's, man, I can't imagine it's almost like Trader Joe's. It's like, hey, you know, we want your product in our grocery store, but you have to call it Trader Joe's. Like, it has to have the Trader Joe's logo. And that's exactly what you're doing too with the other companies.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Like, I approach people now and I'll say, hey, I can make chalk for you with your branding on it. And you'd be shocked at the number of people that respond to those emails that would never give you the time of day. Mm-hmm. I mean, huge companies that would never respond to a normal email. But as soon as you say, we want to make it with your brand on it, all of a sudden then, like, everyone's interested.
Yeah, of course. So out of all the people, all the companies that you know about, what's one company that you haven't gotten your hand in that you would like to, you know, put your chalk into?
The gymnastics distributors. There's four of them. It's almost like the mafia. There's a Northeast, Southeast, Southwest, and Northwest, and they've been around for decades and decades, since like the 40s or 50s. And the Northeast distributor distributes to all the gyms in that area. And the same thing with the Southeast. And they have this gentleman's agreement that you don't come to my place and I won't come to your place. They each order up to 40,000 pounds of chalk per year, and they distribute to their territory. And years ago, I spoke with all four of the gymnastics distributors, and I said, we'd love to make chalk for you. And they said, well, we ordered a whole year ahead. So we order in January of 2024 and we pay for it, and it gets delivered in January of 2025. And I said at the time, well, keep me in mind. I'd love to make chalk for you. Well, as years went by, it got harder and harder and harder to make chalk for them because this relationships that they have get more and more embedded, and it's harder for them to turn away from that. Right.
Yep.
So 3 years ago, there was some interest, you know, or let's say 5 years ago, there was some interest. Over the last 5 years, it's really waned because they've made this mind, you know, we've already spoken to you, and, you know, we kind of have this deal that we've been doing for a couple decades and it works for us. And they get very old school in that, like, this is how it's done.
Yeah. And they don't want to change it. Yeah.
They don't want to change it. Not because it's not better. And they all admit, we think your chalk is better, but this is the way it's always been done.
Yeah.
And then they go, thanks for calling though. They're the nicest guys,
of course. Yeah, I mean, they can only do so much, you know.
They're all old too, and when you get to a certain age, you just kind of look at everything in your life and you go, I don't want to deal with it. And that's the mentality they have with their whole life.
Yeah,
so, I get it. It's just that, you know, I'd love to win them over.
Yeah, I have a great example. So the hospital I used to work at in Boston, we were all like just documenting on paper, like that's it. And then all of a sudden they wanted to get into computerized documentation. Like, they use like a medical system called Epic. And so all the older nurses just were not all about that. They're like, I don't want to do this. This is not, you know, I don't like this. This is not what I'm used to. And so I can definitely see, you know, what the gymnastics group is thinking. They're like, oh, we've done this for so long, like, why change it? And all of a sudden, like, you just throw like a curveball and they're just like, oh, what's going on?
Well, one of the cool things that I've noticed over the last year is you have, I'm gonna throw out a number, but let's say 50 chalk companies in America. When I say chalk companies, there are people who just order off of Alibaba, you know,
yeah,
get it shipped over. But they're a company in that they have their own logo on the box, which makes them a company technically.
Yeah.
This year I started approaching a lot of those guys and said, hey, keep us in mind. If you go to order from China this year or next year, just approach me and we'll throw you some pricing. And a massive portion of those guys have said, yeah, like it's a hassle. They don't speak English. They're always changing the deal on us. It's sketchy quality. You'll get some great stuff. And then 6 weeks later, they send you a bunch of stuff that's terrible. And so the quality is always up and down. And so we've been able to convert a lot of people from ordering from China to ordering from us. And one of the reasons that's so exciting is because it's very difficult to compete in a commodities market where price seems to be the only thing that people care about. And that's what we were told in the beginning. Don't get into chalk. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is price. If you're 5 cents cheaper, you'll sell more than the next guy. And I said, well, that might be true, but I'm willing to throw my hat in the ring and see what happens.
Yeah.
But fast forward 8 years later, and we're convincing people who are paying half the price to come to us and switch over. And the dream and the goal is over the next 3 to 5 years is to be able to get on Amazon, and the top 20 results for chalk are different brands, but all us.
Nice.
That's the goal.
Awesome. Awesome. So do you have any products that you are looking to start in 2024 that you think no one knows about yet?
No, I think like we stick to the basics. There's this tendency with equipment companies to come out with something new every week, because then you can hand it out to your influencers and the YouTube review guys and the home gym guys. And you have this little network of 50 or 60 influencers and you send out new stuff to them. Well, they're always looking for new content.
Yeah.
So they don't want to go back and review something they've already reviewed. So in order to stay relevant and stay in front of people, you have to constantly come out with new stuff. And I've noticed now they've got little gimmicks. All the equipment companies are coming out with like outdoor wheels that you can attach to your bench in case you need to wheel your bench through gravel. And the other one is, I want to make a 12-inch bench pad that Velcros to my bench underneath. So instead of having a 10-inch bench, I can now put this 12-inch pad on top of it. Now I've got a 12-inch bench pad. Well, $100 for a bench, you might use that 3 times a year. But it doesn't matter to equipment companies. It was never about selling that particular item. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It was about coming out with something new that's silly and gimmicky and may sell 5 a week. But it's something to send to all the social media guys, the influencers, who can now do a video on it. Well, those people watch that video. They hear the company name. They go to the company website. They don't buy that item. They're buying barbells and clips and rigs and rowers. And you know what I'm saying? But what it does is it drives traffic. So the philosophy was never about coming out with an original product or a valuable product. It was about coming out with some silly bunch of nonsense that you can just give out every week that in turn drives traffic to the website. And that's the pervading wisdom right now. If you look at the way the winds are blowing, for us, we want to avoid doing that. I don't want to come out with a bunch of gimmicky products and try to get in front of people all the time. I'd rather just make really good chalk and just see what happens. So the answer to that question is, I think we have a solid product lineup. The only thing I'd like to do is I have the plans to make our 4 ounce block with a split down the middle. So if you want to crack it in half and make it into 2 2-ounce blocks, you can. And there's a lot of people that want 2 ounce blocks, but I don't want to make 2 ounce blocks. I want to make a 4 ounce block with a slit through the middle so that it can be either. It can be a 4 ounce block or you can crack it. So that's my next thing. And that's not going to take long. We could do that in a week.
Nice. So speaking about influencers, so I've noticed on your Instagram page, you've had a lot of, you know, people in the fitness space that have tested out spider chalk in, you know, by the looks of it, they really, really like it. So how did you reach out to those guys? And, you know, obviously you don't pay them. You just give them like a free sample and say, hey, you know, test it out and be honest.
Yeah. So I come from a sales background. It's my passion. One day I'd like to have so much inventory sitting in a warehouse that I could go back to selling. And that's what I love doing. I could close the deal with the gymnastics distributors. Mm-hmm. I'd love to be in Walmart. I'd love to be in Dick's Sporting Goods and REI. And we've talked with all these people, but there's a point when we have to serve Rogue and Amazon and those people first. I can't give Walmart product and not give it to Rogue. We have a 4-year, 5-year relationship with Rogue and the private label stuff. So to answer your question, what was your question again? Tell me.
No, you're good. So you've had influencers on your Instagram page and testing the stuff. So
Yes. So coming from that sales background, one of the things I'm very careful of is being pushy. And when I email the guys on YouTube or Instagram, the first thing I say is, hey, do you use chalk? Inevitably, half of them come back and say yes, half of them say no. The ones that say no, there's no point in approaching them because it sits on a shelf and nobody touches it.
Yep.
The ones that say yes, I inevitably say, I'd love to send you some chalk for you to try. And that's it. And then once they receive it, I follow up and I say, hey, enjoy the chalk. Let me know what you think. Let's keep in touch. Because there's no point in being pushy in the beginning when you're trying to make a relationship with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, meeting someone in the gym and, you know, he says, hey, dude, can you spot me? And you go over there and you spot him. And then after that, you're like, hey, bro, we should get together and hang out. Let's, you know, he's like, whoa, dude, you spotted me on one set.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So I think about it like that. Like the way relationships are built is you just continue these long conversations over the course of 6 months or a year. And then eventually they become less of marketing and more of a friendship. And so the majority of the guys that you see on YouTube and Instagram that have talked about our chalk are guys that over the last 6 months to a year have become fairly good business friends, which is cool.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not like, it's almost like LinkedIn. If like literally you get like an email, like saying, hey, I like to connect. We seem like we have like the same group of people we connect with. And then like you connect with them and like instantly they're like, yes. Hey, I want to sell you something. It's just like, holy cow, man. Like, you know, I am not into this. Like just, and I automatically like unconnect with them. It's just annoying, you know, getting
and chalk is weird too, because chalk is not sexy and chalk is not flashy and chalk is not expensive and it doesn't get a lot of views. The guys that do chalk reviews, which I'm very thankful for, they're always low view videos. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can put on their unbelievable secret recipe to amazing grip and the algorithm will pick it up. But then eventually after a week, nobody cares and it just kind of drifts away. If you do the brand new Rogue, you know, GHD / bench, you know, newfangled thing they came out with, you're going to get 500,000 views on that because there's so many people that want to know what the new Rogue drop is.
Yeah.
But nobody's sitting around, you know, frantically wanting to see more stuff about chalk. And so because of that, I know my place in the hierarchy of sexiness online. We have a functional product, but we're just not sexy. And I'm okay with that. I mean, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we talk to influencers, one of the things I tell them is like, don't feel like you have to do the Bells of Steel 20-minute video, man. You know, just say you enjoy it and it helps your grip. That's all.
Yeah. That's all you need. That's all you need. But I know since you moved to that new area, you actually are building your own gym. So I kind of want to talk about that as well. So like how big is a gym? Like, what are you looking to put into it? And like, what made you decide to like build your own like warehouse of a gym?
So there's two reasons we decided to build it. One is because we've been to so many gyms up here and they don't have the equipment we want. They're not open the hours we want. Mm-hmm. Stuff's always broken. Mm-hmm. And they never fix it. They don't take any pride in their space. And also because I do CrossFit, we're a pain to the other people that work out there. People come in and they go, are you using this? We go, yes. Are you using that? Yes. Are you going to use this bench? We're also using that. What are you not using? And I said, well, we're not using that treadmill over there. And so over time, you get this reputation as like, people come in and they see you and they go, oh no, these CrossFit people are in here again, you know? And so that was one of the big reasons is that we do CrossFit. The second is because of all the broken stuff and the gyms around here just don't have good equipment. They tend to do a lot of machines, your hammer strength stuff. So yep. We built our own gym. The reason we built our own gym, though, is a lot of it is because of content, too, because we want to film a lot of content. And it's hard to film content when you're in a commercial gym, when people are walking in front of the camera and everyone's talking and the lighting's atrocious.
Yeah.
And there's always some guy over there with, like, you know, the wife beater on, grunting really loud. So So that's why we did it. And I'll tell you another thing is that back in the day, this is one of the differences between CrossFit then and CrossFit now, which it has changed a lot. Back in the day, it was a source of pride at how little equipment you had.
And how dirty it was.
Yeah. And you'd walk in and there'd be a rig and some crusty barbells and like one Dynamax ball and then a set of rusted dumbbells, an old kettlebell with chips off it, and then one of those Concept 2 rowers with the wood handles.
I have one in my house right now. I literally have
Model B or something.
The OG, the original. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember walking into all these different CrossFits in like 2007, 2008, 2009, and walking in and going, whoa, this place looks like a torture dungeon. You know, like the flickering lights.
Yep.
You know, 'cause there's like a light bulb out.
Yep.
You know? And that was like the whole thing with CrossFit. Greg Glassman sold everybody on in the beginning was you can have Olympic caliber training.
Yeah.
Space like that costs less for less than $1,000 in equipment. And then think about over the last 15 years how that's changed. Now you walk in and it's air conditioning and they've got locker rooms and they've got the cold plunge and the hot sauna and the red light therapy and they've got nutrition counseling and a smoothie bar. And a lot of affiliates have chiropractors or massage therapists on staff. Dude, 15 years ago, if you had a dirt floor and some bumper plates and a pull-up bar, you had a CrossFit. That was it, dude.
Yeah. It was almost like back in the day, if it wasn't dirt, if you weren't able to get a tetanus shot, like after you worked out, it wasn't worth like going to that gym.
Yeah. And our gym is very much like that. Like I purposely am making it as Spartan as possible. And it's going to be funny in the videos because we're going to film this. And everyone's going to go, when does your gym open? We're like, oh man, we've been open for 6 months. This is it. This is everything we got.
Nice.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about that.
Awesome. So we're getting close to the end. So I have a couple of like rapid fire questions. Like I've always tell people they're not really rapid fire. So you can take as long as you want with this. So do you have any goals for the rest of, for 2024?
Yeah, my goal for 2024 is two things. I want to automate a lot of our processes so we can get faster, so we can do bigger orders. The second thing is I want to do more private label.
Okay. All right. Awesome. What is your favorite book? It can be fiction, nonfiction, biography, like whatever.
So I read one or two books a week.
Holy crap,
man. I'm a prolific reader.
Wow.
In fact, the month of February, every year I read 10 or more books in the month of February. And I pick them out way ahead of time. And I don't read like 100-page books. I read like 400 to 600-page books. So I like really big books. Rich Dad, Poor Dad's my favorite finance book. And my favorite nonfiction book. I actually have favorite authors. I like Stephen Pressfield a lot. He's the guy that wrote Gates of Fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's big on Rome and the ancient Romans. And I like Prince of Tides, which is a Southern Pat Conroy. He writes about the South. I have so many favorite authors. This is a tough question, but I'd probably say Stephen Pressfield is my favorite fiction. And then my nonfiction is Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Okay. So you said in February, you're going to try to read 10 books. So how do you have time to work and have a family and be able to read all these books all at once?
So I go to bed anywhere between 8 and 8:30 at night. And I lay in bed and I read my Kindle. And then I also have books that I read throughout the day in various places around the house. I have multiple Kindles and also have paperback books. So I'm always, always, always reading. I don't spend a lot of time on my phone. And also I'm a really fast reader.
Okay. So do you prefer the Kindle or just like a regular book?
I prefer the Kindle because you can put a lot of books on there. You can read it really fast. You can make the font bigger. which my eyes are starting to go now as I'm getting older. So I can make the font bigger, and definitely like the Kindles is the way to go.
Okay. I have the Barnes and Noble version of the Kindle, and yep, like, this is like old school. And so I'm like, it's great and all, but it's like, not for me, nothing beats like holding an actual physical book.
Yeah.
And reading it.
There's a lot of people like that, that there's something about like the textile, you know, having it in their hands. It's like, it like nostalgic almost or something.
Yeah,
for me, it's about just slapping through like as much content as possible.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. What is something that, that no one knows about, like about you?
Myself or Spider Chalk?
You.
Myself?
Yeah, yourself.
Myself? Oh gosh, man. I wrote a book in 2020. Maybe it was 2023. It was either 2022 or 2023, but it's called Conquering the Need to Conquer. And it's a memoir. And it's extremely interesting about my life. It starts when I was a kid and it goes all the way up until about 2 years ago. And it's pretty wild. I mean, writing a book is really cool. And publishing a book is really cool. But the process was amazing. I even did the audiobook myself.
Oh, shoot.
The audiobook myself. Yeah.
That's awesome. All right. I'll definitely have to look into that too. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's awesome. So next question, what is in your gym bag?
So my gym bag has a Velcro weightlifting belt, the little roller thing that runners use where you can massage your muscles with the yep, little roller on it.
Yep.
Some wrist wraps that a girl from my gym made for me. They're UGA wrist wraps that she sewed herself. I've got a Skull Smash ammonia that you can smell. I've got liquid Spider Chalk in there.
Of course.
Yeah, I've got some clips because at most gyms, they have spring clips. So I have the clips that snap on and off.
Yep.
I also have an inhaler because I have horrible asthma. So anytime I do a Metcon that I know is going to be really brutal, I always do my asthma inhaler.
Yep.
And then aside from that, I have a jump rope, a speed rope, which I do a lot of jump roping, double unders. And I used to have my Olympic weightlifting shoes in there, but I don't carry those anymore because you can't really Olympic weightlift at most commercial gyms. You can, but then like people get really angry. So after a long time of not using them, I just took them out of the gym bag.
Okay.
So I think that's probably it.
All right. All right. So this is kind of going to be like a little like deep, but so it's your last day on earth and you have all your friends around you. How do you want people to know you as?
Well, I'm a believer. I'm a Christian. So the first thing I want people to say about me is that I reflected Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's because my grandfather was a pastor. When he died, him and my grandmother both died. They had these amazing funerals where people got up and they talked about the incredible effect they had on their life, on their spiritual life and their emotional life. And, you know, you can die with all the money in the world and you can die with all the success in the world. But when it comes down to your funeral and what people say about you, they never mention that. Mm-hmm. What they mention is the way that you made them feel and how loyal you were to them and how loving and kind you were. And so my last day on earth, I'd really want people to see me very Christ-like, meaning I want people to think that I understand that I love them and I love them regardless of a lot of the choices they make.
Yeah.
If you screw up and you make bad choices, that's okay. I've made a lot of bad choices. I wrote a memoir about it. And if you're not going to be friends with the people that make bad choices, then you're not going to be friends with me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you probably wouldn't be friends with anybody.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, my last day, that's what I'd want.
Okay. So next question, no one else is going to be answering this question except for you. So do you think Georgia got hosed out of the championship playoffs?
Absolutely, dude. Alabama, man. Something about those guys, they just get lucky. College football has a crazy obsession with them. So back in 2004, when I graduated from UGA, USC was really big, the Trojans.
Yep. Yeah, I remember
We used to call ESPN the All Trojan Network because it doesn't matter. There'd be like 9 teams with upsets and they'd show 60 seconds for each game. Then they'd do a 20-minute segment on the Trojans. And everyone's
it's like, come on, guys, really? You know?
So, and that reminds me of Alabama. Like, Alabama can lose 3 games a year and everyone's going to talk about how they're the greatest team that ever, and Nick Saban and blah, blah, blah. And like, you just, it's just part of ingrained right now. Everyone's obsessed with Alabama, and they're going to get a free ride
anywhere. Yeah. Well, yep. I'm glad. I'm a big Michigan fan, so I was really glad that they beat them.
Yes.
Because I really thought FSU should have made it into the playoffs, even though they're like their all-star quarterback got hurt and stuff. It's like they literally went undefeated and won the ACC championship and still didn't make it, and it was for like a one-loss team like Alabama. I'm like, how is that fair? It's like you're pretty much telling me everyone has a chance except for if you get close. If you're next to Alabama, forget about it.
Did you see the bowl game with Georgia and FSU?
I did see that. Well, the only thing was I've heard was there were like 25 players that either went to the transfer portal or didn't even play. So it's like kind of I can't use that as a sample because of all those athletes that weren't there.
Well, what I was going to say was because FSU didn't make and Georgia, all the players who would have played decided not to risk it. And they just, you know, it means nothing. If we win, it means nothing. If we lose, it means nothing. So why risk an ACL tear or a concussion, you know? And so college football now has become this whole thing. Like if there's no skin in the game, everyone just gracefully bows out and says, I'm not going to play anymore. And that's what happened with the FSU Georgia game. That was a joke. There was no point in even playing that. I mean, the people there were bored. The players were bored. The coaches were bored. I was bored. You know, I'm sitting here, I'm a huge Georgia fan, and I was bored out of my mind. My kids were bored. I'm like, you know, if we're going to do this, you know, then just let's just stop the whole charade.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. And I agree that, and I think the NIL deals and all that stuff and the transfer portals just get getting completely out of hand.
Yeah. But they're going to have to put some restraints on that because there are teams leaving UGA to go other places on a losing team, knowing they're going down from a championship national, you know, national championship level team to a scrub team because they're going to make more money.
Yep.
And they're not looking to be the best. They're not looking to improve. They're looking to just make some cash on the side, some quick cash. And it's too tempting. I mean, if you're 19 years old or 20 years old, it's too tempting. And even if your parents and your mentors are saying, don't do it, you're going to take the quick money.
Yeah. I heard last thing. So Marvin, I heard Marvin Harrison almost was going to get an NIL deal for $4 million or like some ungodly amount of money just to stay at Ohio State for another year.
Yeah.
And he's literally could be the second overall pick.
Right.
And it's like, God, it's like, really, is it really worth it? Like, yeah, he won't be playing college football, but he'll be making a boatload of money, but then he may get hurt and then not play for the rest of his life.
I know, man. And that's where it has to be enough money that if you get hurt, you're good. Right.
Yep.
So that's how much true. Is that ACL tear worth to you? Is it worth $500,000? Could you put that in an investment fund and live off it for the next 20 years? Can you support a wife and a kids? You know what I mean? If you can, then go for it. If you can't, then you really need to think hard about, but you know, I don't want to be in their shoes. When I was in college, I remember all the athletes were driving like hoopties. You know, I'd see them and they'd have like these like 1992, you know, Chevy cars with like no hubcaps on it.
Yeah.
And you knew it was a football team because they were all, you know, they're little compact cars.
Yep. Yep.
You know, the little tiny like two-door Chevy coupes, and it'd be like some dude that was 330 pounds in there. And you're like, oh, there's a football player.
Yep.
But they're just broke. So, you know, I like the name and likeness thing. I do like that they can make some money, but it's definitely gotten out of hand. And in the next few years, they'll probably have to do something as far as putting a cap on it. They'll have to.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the whole thing's just going to fall apart.
Yeah. It's just going to be a whole mess. But so last question, where can people reach out to you if they have any questions about like your chalk buying it or, you know, whatnot?
Yeah. So we're on Rogue and Amazon and Walmart. I mean, you can get our chalk anywhere. If you just go to Google and type in spider chalk, then we're going to come up. But if you want a private label, you have to contact us directly through the website. And if you email me and say, hey, I've got this brand or I want to start a brand and I want someone to make chalk in the United States, we're the only people you can go to. So if you want to order from China, you've got 500 different places you can go, Alibaba, AliExpress, whatever. But if you want to order from an American company, we're the only manufacturer in the U.S. So you got to come to us if you want a private label.
Nice. Nice.
I want to do one more question.
Yeah. Go for it.
All right, so I thought you were going to ask me this and you didn't. What do you think about the $4,500 affiliate raise?
Oh, you know what? Dang it. I literally have it on a question here. I forgot to do it because like I kind of wanted to make it like a smooth thing, but I think it's okay. I mean, I'm kind of iffy on it because my thing is, from what I've heard, is a lot of people that were like the OG CrossFit affiliates were grandfathered in at a certain price point.
Yep, they were.
And it's so, you know, all of a sudden they went from, let's just say their annual fee was like $1,000, and now they have to pay an extra, you know, $3,500 for like, you know, plus $1,000 or whatever, just to be an affiliate of CrossFit. So I have a feeling this is gonna maybe have some people that were already thinking about not reaffiliating, just doing their own thing, but actually still do CrossFit. And yeah. I don't, you know, is it gonna help CrossFit make money? Sure, absolutely. But yeah, it's just, I don't know if it's gonna be beneficial. Yeah, because I've heard people, like one person I know, she was like, I don't want to pay the extra $1,500. I'd rather use that to buy equipment or other materials that I could use to benefit the gym instead of paying CrossFit for CAP? Like, I already do my own programming. So like, what are they going to help me out with?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Back when it was $1,000, what I paid, I got grandfathered in. I had two CrossFit gyms. We were 1,000. And even that, it was a stretch at the time. And there were a lot of gyms in 2010, 2011 pushing back and saying, $1,000, what do we get for that?
Yeah.
And they said, well, you can use the CrossFit name. And we said, okay, so what? You know, like, what does that do for me? I get to put the word CrossFit on a sign that no one sees.
Yeah.
And at the time, they never had an answer for that. HQ never answered that question. They would say, well, we're doing the games. Okay, well, the average mom that's 42 years old, again, the 28-year-old that's 50, 60 pounds overweight, the guy training for the high school football team, he doesn't care about the CrossFit games. He's already playing a real sport.
Yeah.
And, I mean, literally, dude, for the past 16 years, since 2007, HQ has never answered that question. What does the money pay for? No one's complaining about $1,000. No one's complaining about $4,500.
Yep.
You have to tell us what we get for $4,500. And no one wants to answer that question. Well, they do answer it. It's the answer they like, not the answer the affiliate owners like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think this whole house of cards is about to come falling down. I predicted it in 2016. I said, you wait, CrossFit's going to fall apart. And I'll tell you why at the time I thought that. A house divided cannot stand. The majority of CrossFits in Atlanta and in the Southeast. Now, I don't know about California and Washington and Oregon, but I know in Tennessee, Alabama, South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida, the majority of CrossFits come from trainers. So a trainer works at a gym for 6 months or a year. He moves a mile or two away and opens up a CrossFit gym. And he starts poaching members from his previous gym.
Yep.
That guy stays in business 3 to 4 years. One of his coaches leaves and moves another mile or two down the road and starts coaching. Now, how do you separate your gym from the gym that's 1 mile down the road and another gym that's one more mile down the road? How do you differentiate yourself from the guy across the street and the guy at the corner and the guy two corners down? Well, I'll tell you how they did it. This was in 2015, 2016. They trashed them. You don't want to go there. Everybody there gets hurt. That guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's charging people a sign-up fee. Now, whether all that stuff is true or not, that's not really the point. The point is it became everybody in the CrossFit community is bad-mouthing everybody else.
Yep.
I saw that. And I saw coaches leave my gym and open up a mile away and then get on Facebook and start approaching my members and saying, hey, if you'll come to me, I'll give you a 50% discount. And you know how insulting it is to give someone a job and pay them for a year and then have that same person go behind your back and open up a gym a mile away and then attempt to steal your customers? The problem with that is the same thing happens to that guy and on and on and on. Now, because that happens so much, it created this animosity in the CrossFit community. Now owners don't want to get together. They don't want to see anyone else succeed. They want to see everybody else fail. And when you're in an organization that wants to see other people in the organization fail, the whole organization's doomed. Now, right now, it's surviving. It's diminishing, but it's surviving. Over the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to see a drastic decrease in the number of CrossFit affiliates. And a lot of people are going to rebrand and be such and such strength and conditioning,
yep,
or whatever, which is what you're already seeing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the other side of it is, I saw this back in 2008. CrossFit is whatever you want it to be. And I'll give you an example. I know this is getting long-winded, but we can chop it up.
No, you're good. No, I'm dead. No, keep on going, man. Keep on going.
This is what I mean by CrossFit can mean anything. CrossFit HQ has done a horrible job of defining what CrossFit is. Is it high-intensity functional movements, right? Is it a variety of functional movements done at high intensity? Is that what it is? Or is it the sport of fitness? Or is it both? If it's variety of movements done at high intensity, I can go to LA Fitness and I can do my hammer strength machines, because those are functional to 90% of Americans, right?
Yeah.
Functional in that I have to press things, right? So they'll go and do their little circuit. And then at the end of it, they're pouring sweat and they look at their watch and they say, man, I did 5 circuits on the hammer strength in 10 minutes. That's CrossFit. And then you have the guys out back flipping tires, right? And doing jump rope, and that's CrossFit. Then you have the people doing Olympic lifting, and that's CrossFit. And then you have the guys on the treadmill. That's CrossFit, because they're doing sprints on a treadmill. What is CrossFit? Well, CrossFit is anything you want it to be. And because of that, people used to come to my gym and go, I'm already doing CrossFit. And I go, where? And they go, LA Fitness. I go, but they don't have bumper plates. And they go, yeah, so what? I do bench press and I do curls, you know?
Yep.
And yeah. I do the dip machine with the plate stack thing. I do dips. I'm doing CrossFit already. And I go, but that's not CrossFit. They go, sure it is. Why isn't it CrossFit?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where you go, oh no, everybody's doing CrossFit, but no one's paying for an affiliate. And so between that side of it, of everybody thinking they're doing CrossFit, or I can do it at home, or I can do it in a parking lot, or I can do it in my living room with some 5-pound dumbbells and a yoga mat. If you can do CrossFit at home with your yoga mat and 5-pound dumbbells, truly do CrossFit, you don't need to be paying $150 a month to go to an affiliate. Between that and the fact that all the owners are starting to destroy each other, and they spend more energy talking bad about them than they do about talking about what they offer.
Yeah.
Because of that, you're going to start to see a big decline in the number of CrossFits. And are you involved in like the Reddit forums for CrossFit?
I'm part of it, but I haven't really like delved deep into it. So yeah. I mean, it's like there's so many social media apps out there. It's just it's in like listen to podcasts. It is so hard to like catch up on like everything.
Well, I'm objective. I love CrossFit. I do CrossFit. I own 2 affiliates and sold them. But it's crushing to get on Facebook groups and Reddit groups that pertain to CrossFit. There's so much fighting and negative energy.
Yep.
Someone will ask a question and say, I'm at this affiliate. I'm doing this program. It's been 6 weeks. I only put like 5 pounds on my bench press, or my clean and jerk only went up from 135 to 145 and I'm 185-pound man. What do you think? And just wait. There's 400 comments on there about the owner's crap, the gym's terrible, you need to leave, he doesn't know what he's doing, you need to join an Olympic weightlifting gym, you need to leave CrossFit and do powerlifting. It's just so much negativity. And I think that stems from the top. When we were an owner, I had to take my certification 3 times as an owner. That's 3 times I had to pay, and that's 3 times I had to leave my family for a whole weekend to go get recertified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I actually emailed HQ and said, I'm not going to do this. I'm one of your oldest affiliates. Like the third time I'm not doing it. I just got recertified. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In fact, I showed up to that certification and I've been doing CrossFit 4 years longer than the trainers. do the math.
Yeah.
And it was such a toxic environment, because I emailed them and pled my case and said, I don't want to get recertified a third time as an affiliate owner. And they emailed me back and they said, either get certified or we'll take away your affiliation. Like, screw you.
Wow.
And I was like, bro, I've been paying you all this money and supporting you for 8 years. And their response to me was basically, screw off. And then you wonder why the coaches and the owners and the Reddit groups and the Facebook groups hate on each other constantly, you know? Mm. And then you think about, like, well, what direction is CrossFit going to go in? Well, if you look at the bottom level of CrossFit, I'll tell you the direction it's going in. And the direction it's going is, it's self-destructing. Mm-hmm. And for anybody that's in the CrossFit community, if there's any chance of saving this thing, the people at the top have to go stop. Imagine having six kids who just fight and argue all the time, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the dad's fault. You know, the parents have to step in and go, we're not fighting anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to love each other. And, you know, we're going to learn to love each other or it's going to hurt.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's where, like, the $4,500 comes in. You know, a lot of people are looking at HQ right now and saying $4,500 is a lot of money, and they're willing to pay it, but they're not getting any love from the top. You know, who's reaching out to these people and going, tell me your story. Like, you've been an affiliate for 12 years. Why? Why do you continue to do this year after year?
Yep.
And listen to their story and then say, well, I understand why you don't want to pay $4,500. And this is why we're doing it. And if that doesn't work for you, let me know. And we'll come up with some way to make it special for you, you know? And if they're not willing to do that, then they're just going to go ahead and close. They might as well just close the doors, because you're not going to salvage this thing by telling people to screw off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that the one big problem is, as well, is they have all these investors that put their money involved into CrossFit. And so they're expecting some, like, you know, in the green, you know, because I guess supposedly, like, last year they were just like in the black, like, they were in the black. They were just like,
yeah,
didn't make a profit, didn't make any profit supposedly. And now they're like, okay, we need to make more money. And so this is probably the only way that we could do this. And then adding 25% more people instead of the top 10% to go to quarterfinals, everyone knows it's a money grab. Everyone. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, like, we're not stupid. I mean, it's like, we know that you're losing money. It's just that, like, and even you have supposedly Noble's no longer a sponsor of the CrossFit Games anymore, because yeah, they're a flash in the pants company that doesn't, you know, that just went overboard all at once. And now supposedly GORUCK's the new sponsor of the CrossFit Games. And I'm like, all right, great. How long are they going to last? You know? And then the amount of money that they're paying the athletes to that are podium is, like, astronomical.
Now, here's a good question for you. You've been into CrossFit for a while, and I want to prove a point here. Who sponsored the games in 2022? Do you know anybody?
It was
obviously, like, Noble or whatever, but, like,
yeah,
there was, like, 40 sponsors of the CrossFit games. Could you name them?
I think RX Smart Gear was one. There was a CBD company that was part of that. Cause I remember, I think I saw them on one wall, and I think, yep, maybe, oh gosh, what was it? Fade Aid, I think, maybe had their,
yep,
their pause in there. Gosh, what else?
Kill Cliff was in there a few years ago.
Yep, that was old. That's old school.
So now let's go back. 2018. Obviously, Kill Cliff, Rogue. Anybody else that you can remember? 2017, 2016, 2015. Do you remember?
Well, there was obviously Reebok was there for a while. Yeah.
Yep. This is my point. Do you know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars these companies are paying to sponsor the CrossFit Games? Now, obviously, okay, higher levels pays more.
Yeah.
Lower levels don't pay as much. We got asked 5 years ago, 4 years ago, if we wanted to get involved with CrossFit, like, on a partnership level. And I don't mean a sponsorship level. I mean a partnership level.
Yeah.
And I said no. And I've never told anybody this because it makes me look like I don't care about CrossFit. But that's not true. I do. I love CrossFit. But almost everybody that gets involved with CrossFit becomes a toxic brand because you're being associated with the toxic brand, right? And I'll give you an example. Go back and look at the CrossFit Games from 2015, 2016, 2017, 2013, 2014. The majority of those companies are smaller than they were 5 years ago, if they're still in business.
Yep.
So imagine paying $50,000 or $70,000 to be in front of millions of people, get your brand out in front of millions of people you know are your target market. And then 3 years later, look at your sales every year have dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped to the point where you're either no longer in business or you're not even relevant in the entire market space. If you could go back in the last 7 years from 2016 to 2023 and find me 10 companies that sponsored the CrossFit Games that are bigger now than they were when they started sponsoring CrossFit, I'd give you $1,000 because you can't do it.
Nope.
And what does that tell you? What does that tell you? Right?
Yeah.
From the brand's perspective, when someone approaches you and says, do you want to advertise? Well, if I advertise with you, it looks like I'm going to go out of business. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looks like. Unless you can prove me otherwise, everybody else that sponsored your events went out of business. So there's something that's killing off these big brands with valuable products that were popular at the time. Noble's no exception. I mean, look at the games to 2023 and 2022. I'll bet you 2026, 2027, the majority of those will either be small or out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And we're growing, and there's a lot of other small brands that are continuing to grow, but they sure as heck don't tie themselves to the CrossFit brand. We're not a CrossFit chalk. We're a powerlifting chalk. We're a gymnastics chalk. We're a rock climbing chalk. We're a home gym chalk, but we're certainly not a CrossFit chalk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that, because you don't need our chalk to do CrossFit. You need our chalk if you're lifting or you're doing calisthenics, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're doing kettlebells or you're doing grip. That's what you need our stuff for. And the reason I bring that up is because to get an accurate picture of CrossFit, people don't really want to take a look at themselves, right? A hard look at themselves. And whether you own a gym and you take a hard look at the way you're programming and what your clients are saying, or whether you're a coach and you're getting negative feedback about the way you're giving coaching cues, or whether you're a business owner, it's tough to look at yourself objectively and say, I'm just not that good at certain things. And that's something that CrossFit has never done. They've been so egotistical and so arrogant. And part of the reason they've been so egotistical and arrogant is because they've gotten away with it since 1999. But those days are coming to an end, and there needs to be some soul searching from the organization that says, if we're going to continue on for decades, we need to go back and say, it's not about the money. It's about the people, just like Greg Glassman said. And once you win over the people, then you win over the money. And they're not willing to do that right now. They're not willing to do it with the CrossFit Games athletes, and they're certainly not willing to do it with the affiliates. And mm-hmm. I know that because I'm still friends with a lot of CrossFit owners, and we talk to each other all the time. And they tell me the same thing. They say, like, I'm just sick and tired of this. It never changes, you know? And every time they get someone new in there, they say it's going to be different, and it's never different.
No. Nope.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, that's like my whole CrossFit spiel, my whole perspective. And it sounds really negative, but it's not, because as a brand, it has so much value, but they're just screwing it up, man. You know?
Yeah.
Just screwing it up. And it's sad. It just makes me so sad to see what's happened to it over the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the potential of what it could be, you know?
Yep. No, I agree.
Yeah.
Dang. Yeah. I'm definitely going to cut this up and put this earlier on in the show. Yeah. So, dude, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah,
like,
man.
I really do appreciate it. Like, this was like learning about your experience in CrossFit, your expertise, like being an OG CrossFit, you know, CrossFit guy. Yeah, it was awesome. Even learning about your business too, Spider Chalk. We're like, you know, the non-sexy chalk company, but your guys are absolutely killing it.
Yeah. So here's my like recommendation for if you're going to chop it up, get rid of the ones that like aren't that interesting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just realistically, like there's certain things that just like, it's cool for me and you, but you know, the average person watching it, they get 15 minutes in and they're like glassy eyed, you know?
Oh, I know. Yeah. I've been doing,
I always talk about it. I always tell people when I do podcasts, I go, I'm that guy at the party where people go, so what do you do for a living? And I go, do you really want to know? I mean, like, really? And then after like 60 seconds, they're like, oh God, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why I'm going to stop recording right now.